Once, as a boy of 7, Thomas spent a whole day laboring in his room, carving his father a model sailboat. He did it with no way of knowing that Peter had covered himself with glory that day on the archery range, with his father in attendance. Peter was not, ordinarily, much of a bowman. In that area, at least, Thomas would turn out to be far superior to his older brother. But on that one day, Peter had shot the junior course of targets like one inspired. Thomas was a sad boy, a confused boy, and he was often an unlucky boy. Thomas had thought of the boat because sometimes, on Sunday afternoons, his father liked to go out to the moat which surrounded the palace and float a variety of model boats. Such simple pleasures made Roland extremely happy, and Thomas had never forgotten one day when his father had taken him, and just him, along. In those days, his father had an advisor whose only job was to show Roland how to make paper boats, and the king had conceived a great enthusiasm for them. On this day, a hoary old carp had risen out of the mucky water and swallowed one of Roland's paper boats whole. Roland had laughed like a boy and declared it was better than a tale about a sea monster. He hugged Thomas very tight as he said so. Thomas never forgot that day. The bright sunshine, the damp, slightly moldy odor of the moat water, the warmth of his father's arms, the scratchiness of his beard. So, feeling particularly lonely one day, he had hit on the idea of making his father a sailboat. It would not be a really great job, and Thomas knew it. He was almost as clumsy with his hands as he was at memorizing his lessons. But he also knew that his father could have any craftsman in Delane, even the great Ellender himself, who was now almost completely blind, make him boats if he so desired. The crucial difference, Thomas thought, would be that Roland's own son had taken a whole day to carve him a boat for his Sunday pleasure. Thomas sat patiently by his window, urging the boat out of a block of wood. He used a sharp knife, nicked himself times without number, and cut himself quite badly once, yet he kept on, aching hands or no. As he worked, he daydreamed of how he and his father would go out on Sunday afternoon and sail the boat, just the two of them, all alone, because Peter would be riding Peony in the woods or off playing with Ben. And he wouldn't even mind if that same carp came up and ate his wooden boat, because then his father would laugh and hug him and say it was better than a story of sea monsters eating Anduin clipper ships whole. But when he got to the king's chamber, Peter was there. And Thomas had to wait for nearly half an hour with the boat hidden behind his back while his father extolled Peter's bowmanship. Thomas could see that Peter was uncomfortable under the unceasing barrage of praise. He could also see that Peter knew Thomas wanted to talk to their father and that Peter kept trying to tell their father so. It didn't matter. None of it mattered. Thomas hated him anyway. At last Peter was allowed to escape. Thomas approached his father, who looked at him kindly enough now that Peter was gone. "I made you something, Dad," he said, suddenly shy. He held the boat behind his back with hands that were suddenly wet and clammy with sweat. "Did you now, Tommy?" Roland said. "Why, that was kind, wasn't it?"
"Very kind, sire,"
said Flag, who happened to be idling nearby. He spoke casually, but watched Thomas with bright interest.
"What is it, lad? Show me."
"I remembered how much you like to have a boat or two out on the moat Sunday afternoons, Dad, and—" He wanted desperately to say, "and I wanted you to take me out with you again sometime, so I made this," but he found he could not utter such a thing. "And so I made you a boat. I spent a whole day, cut myself, and—"
Sitting in his window seat, carving the boat, Thomas had made up a long, eloquent speech which he would utter before bringing the boat out from behind his back and presenting it with a flourish to his father, but now he could hardly remember a word of it, and what he could remember didn't seem to make any sense. Horribly tongue-tied, he took the sailboat with its awkward flapping sail out from behind his back and gave it to Roland. The king turned it over in his big, short-fingered hands. Thomas stood and watched him, totally unaware that he had forgotten to breathe. At last, Roland looked up.
Very nice, Tommy. Canoe, isn't it?"
sailboat.
Don't you see the sail? He wanted to cry. It took me an hour alone just to tie the knots, and it isn't my fault one of them came loose so it flaps.
The king fingered the striped sail, which Thomas had cut from a pillowcase.
So it is. Of course it is. At first I thought it was a canoe, and this was some Oranian girl's wash.
He tipped a wink at Flag, who smiled vaguely at the air and said nothing. Thomas suddenly felt he might vomit quite soon. Roland looked at his son more seriously and beckoned for him to come close. Timidly, hoping for the best, Thomas did so.
It's a good boat, Tommy. Sturdy, like yourself. A bit clumsy, like yourself, but good, like yourself. And if you want to give me a really fine present, work hard in your bowmanship classes so you can take a first-class medal as Pete did today.
Thomas had taken a first in the lower circle bowmanship courses the year before, but his father seemed to have forgotten this in his joy over Peter's accomplishment. Thomas did not remind him. He merely stood there, looking at the boat in his father's big hands. His cheeks and forehead had flushed to the color of old brick.
When it was at last down to just two boys, Peter and Lord Towson's son, the instructor decreed they should draw back another 40 kroner. Towson's boy looked downcast, but Peter just walked to the mark and knocked an arrow. I saw the look in his eyes, and I said to myself, he's won. By all the gods that are, he hasn't even fired an arrow yet, and he's won. And so he had. I tell you, Tommy, you should have been there. You should have...
The king prattled on, putting aside the boat Thomas had labored a whole day to make, with barely a second look. Thomas stood and listened, smiling mechanically, that dull, brick-like flush never leaving his face. His father would never bother to take the sailboat he had carved out to the moat. Why should he? The sailboat was as pukey as Thomas felt. Peter could probably carve a better one blindfolded and in half the time. It would look better to their father, at least. A miserable eternity later, Thomas was allowed to escape.
I believe the boy worked very hard on that boat,
Flag remarked carelessly.
Yes, I suppose he did, Roland said. Wretched-looking thing, isn't it? It looks a little like a dog turd with a handkerchief sticking out of it.
And like something I would have made when I was his age, he added in his own mind. Thomas could not hear thoughts. But a hellish trick of acoustics brought Roland's words to him just as he left the great hall. Suddenly the horrible green pressure in his stomach was 1,000 times worse. He ran to his bedroom and was sick in a basin. The next day, while idling behind the outer kitchens, Thomas spied a half-crippled old dog foraging for garbage. He seized a rock and threw it. The stone flew to the mark. The dog yipped and fell down, badly hurt. Thomas knew his brother, although 5 years older, could not have made such a shot at half the distance, but that was a cold satisfaction because he also knew that Pete never would have thrown a rock at a poor, hungry dog in the first place, especially one as old and decrepit as this one obviously was. For a moment, compassion filled Thomas's heart and his eyes filled with tears. Then, for no reason at all, he thought of his father saying, "Looks a little like a dog turd with a handkerchief sticking out of it." He gathered up a handful of rocks and went over to where the dog lay on its side, dazed and bleeding from one ear. Part of him wanted to let the dog alone, or perhaps heal it as Peter had healed Peony, to make it his very own dog and love it forever. But part of him wanted to hurt it, as if hurting the dog would ease some of his own hurt. He stood above it, undecided, and then a terrible thought came to him. Suppose that dog was Peter. That decided the case. Thomas stood over the old dog and threw stones at it until it was dead. No one saw him, but if someone had, he or she would have thought, there is a boy who is bad. Bad, and perhaps even evil. But the person who saw only the cruel murder of that dog would not have seen what happened the day before, would not have seen Thomas throwing up into a basin and crying bitterly as he did it. He was often a confused boy, often a sadly unlucky boy, but I stick to what I said. He was never a bad boy. Not really. I also said that no one saw the stoning of the mongrel dog behind the outer kitchens, but that was not quite true. Flag saw it that night in his magic crystal. He saw it, and was well pleased by it. XVII. Roland, Sasha, Peter, Thomas. Now there is only one more we must speak of, isn't there? Now there is only the shadowy fifth. The time has come to speak of Flag, as dreadful as that may be. Sometimes the people of Delane called him Flag the Hooded, sometimes simply the Dark Man, for in spite of his white corpse's face, he was a dark man indeed. They called him well-preserved, but they used the term in a way that was uneasy rather than complimentary. He had come to Delane from Garlan in the time of Roland's grandfather. In those days he had appeared to be a thin and stern-faced man of about 40. Now, in the closing years of Roland's reign, he appeared to be a thin and stern-faced man of about 50. Yet it had not been 10 years, or even 20, between then and now. It had been 76 years in all. Babies who had been sucking toothlessly at their mother's breasts when Flag first came to Delane had grown up, married, had children, grown old, and died toothlessly in their beds or their chimney corners. But in all that time, Flag seemed to have aged only 10 years. It was magic, they whispered. And of course, it was good to have a magician at court. A real magician, and not just a stage conjurer who knew how to palm coins or hide a sleeping dove up his sleeve. Yet in their hearts, they knew there was nothing good about Flag. When the people of Delane saw him coming, with his eyes peeking redly out from his hood, they quickly found business on the far side of the street. Did he really come from Garlan, with its far vistas and its purple, dreaming mountains? I do not know. It was, and is, a magical land where carpets sometimes fly, and where holy men sometimes pipe ropes up from wicker baskets, climb them, and disappear at the tops, never to be seen again. A great many seekers of knowledge from more civilized lands like Delane and Andua have gone to Garlan. Most disappear as completely and as permanently as those strange mystics who climb the floating ropes. Those who do return don't always come back changed for the better. Yes, Flag might well have come to Delane from Garlan, but if he did, it was not in the reign of Roland's grandfather, but much, much earlier. He had, in fact, come to Delane often. He came under a different name each time, but always with the same load of woe and misery and death. This time he was Flag. The time before he had been known as Bill Hinch, and he had been the king's Lord High Executioner. Although that time was 250 years past, he was a name mothers still used to frighten their children when they were bad. "If you don't shut up that squalling, I reckon Bill Hinch will come and take you away," they said. Serving as Lord High Executioner under 3 of the bloodiest kings in Delane's long history, Bill Hinch had made an end to hundreds, thousands, some said, of prisoners with his heavy axe. The time before that, 400 years before the time of Roland and his sons, he came as a singer named Browson, who became a close adviser to the king and a queen. Browson disappeared like smoke after drumming up a great and bloody war between Delane and Andua. The time before that... Ah, but why go on? I'm not sure I could if I wanted to. When times are long enough, even the storytellers forget the tales. Flag always showed up with a different face and a different bag of tricks, but 2 things about him were always the same. He always came hooded, a man who seemed almost to have no face, and he never came as a king himself, but always as the whisperer in the shadows, the man who poured poison into the porches of kings' ears. Who was he, really, this dark man? I do not know. Where did he wander between visits to Delane? I do not know that either. Was he never suspected? Yes. By a few. By historians and spinners of tales like me, mostly. They suspected that the man who now called himself Flag had been in Delane before, and never to any good purpose. But they were afraid to speak.
A man who could live among them for 76 years and appear to age only 10 was obviously a magician. A man who had lived for 10 times as long, perhaps longer than that, such a man might be the devil himself. What did he want? That question I think I can answer. He wanted what evil men always want, to have power and use that power to make mischief. Being a king did not interest him because the heads of kings all too often found their way to spikes on castle walls when things went wrong. But the advisors to kings, the spinners in the shadows, such people usually melted away like evening shadows at dawning as soon as the headsman's axe started to fall. Flagg was a sickness, a fever looking for a cool brow to heat up. He hooded his actions just as he hooded his face. And when the great trouble came, as it always did after a span of years, Flagg always disappeared like shadows at dawn. Later, when the carnage was over and the fever had passed, when the rebuilding was complete and there was again something worth destroying, Flagg would appear once more. This time, Flagg had found the kingdom of Delane in exasperatingly healthy condition. Landry, Roland's grandfather, was a drunken old fool, easy to influence and twist, but a heart attack had taken him too soon. Flagg knew by then that Lita, Roland's mother, was the last person he wanted holding the scepter. She was ugly, but good-hearted and strong-willed. Such a queen was not a good growth medium for Flagg's brand of insanity. If he had come earlier in Landry's reign, there would have been time to put Lita out of the way, as he expected to put Peter out of the way, but he'd had only 6 years, and that was not long enough. Still, she had accepted him as an advisor, and that was something. She did not like him much, but she accepted him, mostly because he could tell wonderful fortunes with cards. Lita loved hearing bits of gossip and scandal about those in her court and her cabinet, and the gossip and scandal were doubly good because she got to hear not only what had happened, but what would happen. It was hard to rid yourself of such an amusing diversion, even when you sensed that a person able to do such tricks might be dangerous. Flagg never told the queen any of the darker news he sometimes saw in the cards. She wanted to know who had taken a lover, or who had had words with his wife or her husband. She did not want to know about dark cabals and murderous plans. What she wanted from the cards was relatively innocent. During the long, long reign of Lita, Flagg was chagrined to find his main accomplishment was to be not turned out. He was able to maintain a foothold, but to do little more than that. Oh, there were a few bright spots. The encouragement of bad blood between two powerful squires in the southern barony, and the discrediting of a doctor who had found a cure for some blood infections. Flagg wanted no cures in the kingdom that were not magical, which is to say, given or withheld at his own whim, were examples of Flagg's work during that period. It was all pretty small change. Under Roland, poor, bow-legged, insecure Roland, things marched more quickly toward Flagg's goal, because he did have a goal, you know, in his fuzzy, malevolent sort of way, and this time it was grand indeed. He planned nothing more nor less than the complete overthrow of the monarchy, a bloody revolt that would plunge Delane into 1,000 years of darkness and anarchy, give or take a year or two, of course. 19. In Peter's cool gaze, he saw the very possible derailment of all his plans and careful work. More and more, Flagg came to believe that getting rid of Peter was a necessity. Flagg had overstayed in Delane this time, and he knew it. The muttering had begun. The work so well begun under Roland, the steady rises in taxes, the midnight searches of small farmers' barns and silage sheds for unreported crops and foodstuffs, the arming of the home guards, must continue to its end under Thomas. He did not have time to wait through the reign of Peter as he had through that of his grandmother. Peter might not even wait for the mutterings of the people to come to his ears. Peter's first command as king might well be that Flagg should be sent eastward out of the kingdom, and forbidden ever to come again on pain of death. Flagg might murder an advisor before he could give the young king such advice, but the hell of it was, Peter would need no advisor. He would advise himself. And when Flagg saw the cool, unafraid way the boy, now 15 and very tall, looked at him, he thought that Peter might already have given himself that advice. The boy liked to read, and he liked history, and in the last 2 years, as his father grew steadily grayer and frailer, he had been asking a lot of questions of his father's other advisers and some of his teachers. Many of these questions, too many, had to do either with Flag or with roads which would lead to Flag if followed far enough. That the boy was asking such questions at 14 and 15 was bad. That he was getting comparatively honest answers from such timid, watchful men as the kingdom's historians and Roland's advisers was much worse. It meant that, in the minds of these people, Peter was already almost king, and that they were glad. They welcomed him and rejoiced in him because he would be an intellectual like them. And they also welcomed him because, unlike them, he was a brave boy who might well grow into a lion-hearted king, whose tale would be the stuff of legends. In him, they saw again the coming of the White, that ancient, resilient, yet humble force that has redeemed humankind again and again and again. He had to be put out of the way, had to be. Flack told himself this each night when he retired in the blackness of his inner chambers, and it was his first thought when he awoke in that blackness the next morning. He must be put out of the way, the boy must be put out of the way. But it was harder than it seemed. Roland loved and would have died for either of his sons, but he loved Peter with a particular fierceness, smothering the boy in his cradle, making it look as if the baby death had taken him would have once perhaps been possible, but Peter was now a healthy teenager. Any accident would be examined with all the raging scrutiny of Roland's grief, and Flag had thought more than once that the final irony might be this. Suppose Peter really did die an accidental death, and he, Flag, was somehow blamed for it. A small miscalculation while shinnying up a drainpipe. A slip while crawling around on a stable roof playing Dare You with his friend, Stodd. A tumble from his horse. And what would the result be? Might not Roland, wild in his grief and growing senile and confused in his mind, see willful murder in what was really an accident? And might his eye not turn on Flag? Of course, his eye would turn to Flag before it turned to anyone else. Roland's mother had mistrusted him, and he knew that deep down Roland mistrusted him as well. He had been able to hold that mistrust in check with mingled fear and fascination, but Flag knew that if Roland ever had reason to think Flag had caused or even played a part in the death of his son. Flag could actually imagine situations where he might have to interfere in Peter's behalf to keep the boy safe. It was damnable, damnable! He must be put out of the way, must be put out of the way, must! As the days and weeks and months passed, the drumbeat of this thought in Flag's head grew ever more urgent. Every day Roland grew older and weaker. Every day Peter grew older and wiser, and thus a more dangerous opponent. What was to be done? Flag's thoughts turned and turned and turned on this. He grew morose and irritable. Servants, especially Peter's butler, Brandon, and Brandon's son, Dennis, gave him a wide berth and spoke to each other in whispers of the terrible smells that sometimes came from his laboratory late at night. Dennis, in particular, who would some day take the place of his good old Da, as Peter's butler, was terrified of Flag, and once asked his father if he might say a word about the magician. "To make him safe is all I'm thinking," Dennis said. "Not a word," Brandon said, and fixed Dennis, who was only a boy himself, with a forbidding look. "Not a word will you say. The man's dangerous."
"Then is that not all the more reason?"
Dennis began timidly. A dullard may mistake the rattle of a biter snake for the sound of pebbles in a hollow gourd and put out his hand to touch it, Brandon said. "But our prince is no dullard, Dennis. Now fetch me another glass of bundle gin and say no more on it." So Dennis did not speak of it to Peter, but his love of his young master and his fear of the king's hooded adviser both grew after that short exchange. Whenever he saw Flag sweeping up one of the corridors of the castle in his long, hooded robe, he would draw aside, trembling, thinking, "Biter snake! Biter snake! Watch for him, Peter, and listen for him!" Then, one night, when Peter was 16, just as Flag had begun to believe that there really might not be any way to put an end to the boy without unacceptable risk to himself, an answer came. That was a wild night. A terrible autumn storm raged and shrieked around the castle, and the streets of Delane were empty as people sought shelter from the sheets of chilly rain and the battering wind. Roland had taken a cold in the damp. He took cold more and more easily these days, and Flagg's medicines, potent as they were losing their power to cure him. One of these colds, perhaps even the one he was hacking and wheezing with now, would eventually deepen into the wet lung disease, and that would kill him. Magic medicines were not like doctor's medicines, and Flagg knew that one of the reasons the potions he gave the old king were now so slow to work was that he, Flagg, no longer really wanted them to work. The only reason he was keeping Roland alive was that he feared Peter. "I wish you were dead, old man," Flagg thought with childish anger as he sat before a guttering candle, listening to the wind shriek without and his two-headed parrot mutter sleepily to itself within. "For a row of pins, a very short row at that, I'd kill you myself for all the trouble you and your stupid wife and your elder son have caused me. The joy of killing you would almost be worth the ruin of my plans. The joy of killing you." Suddenly he froze, sitting upright, staring off into the darkness of his underground rooms, where the shadows moved uneasily. His eyes glittered silver. An idea blazed in his mind like a torch. The candle flared a brilliant green and then went out.
"Death!"
One of the parrot's two heads shrieked in the darkness.
"Murder!"
shrieked the other. A Dinette blackness. Unseen by anyone, Flagg began to laugh. 20. Of all the weapons ever used to commit regicide, the murder of a king, none has been as frequently used as poison, and no one has greater knowledge of poisons than a magician. Flagg, one of the greatest magicians who ever lived, knew all the poisons that we know. Arsenic, strychnine, the curare, which steals inward, paralyzing all the muscles and the heart last, nicotine, belladonna, nightshade, toadstool. He knew the poison venoms of 100 snakes and spiders, the clear distillation of the clana lily, which smells like honey, but kills its victims in screaming torments, deadly clawfoot, which grows in the deepest shadows of the dismal swamp. Flagg did not know just dozens of poisons, but dozens of dozens, each worse than the last. They were all neatly ranked on the shelves of an inner room where no servant ever went. They were in beakers, in vials, in little envelopes. Each deadly item was neatly marked. This was Flagg's chapel of screams in waiting, agony's antechamber, foyer of fevers, dressing room for death. Flagg visited it often when he felt out of sorts and wanted to cheer himself up. In this devil's marketplace waited all those things that humans, who are made of flesh and are so weak, dread. Hammering headaches, screaming stomach cramps, detonations of diarrhea, vomiting, collapsing blood vessels, paralysis of the heart, exploding eyeballs, swelling, blackening tongues. Madness. But the worst poison of all Flagg kept separate from even these. In his study there was a desk. Every drawer of this desk was locked, but one was triple-locked, and it was a teak box carved all over with magical symbols, runes and such. The lock on this box was unique. Its plate seemed to be a dull orange steel, but very close inspection showed it was really some sort of vegetable matter. It was, in fact, a cleffa carrot, and once a week Flagg watered this living lock with a tiny spray bottle. The cleffa carrot also seemed to have some dull species of intelligence. If anyone tried to jimmy the cleffa lock open, or even if the wrong someone tried to use the right key, the lock would scream. Inside this box was a smaller box, which opened with a key Flagg wore always around his neck. Inside this second box was a packet. Inside the packet was a small quantity of green sand. Pretty, you would have said, but nothing spectacular. Nothing to write home to Mother about. Yet this green sand was one of the deadliest poisons in all the worlds, so deadly that even Flagg was afraid of it. It came from the desert of Gren. This huge poisoned waste lay even beyond Garlan, and was a land unknown in Delane. Gren could be approached only on a day when the wind was blowing the other way, because a single breath of the fumes which came from the desert of Gren would cause death.
Not instant death. That was not the way the poison worked. For a day or two, perhaps even three, the person who breathed the poison fumes, or even worse, swallowed the grains of sand, would feel fine, perhaps better than ever before in his life. Then suddenly his lungs would grow red hot. His skin would begin to smoke, and his body would shrivel like the body of a mummy. Then he would drop dead, often with his hair on fire. Someone who breathed or swallowed this deadly stuff would burn from the inside out. This was dragon sand, and there was no antidote, no cure. What fun! On that wild, rainy night, Flagg determined to give a bit of dragon sand to Roland and a glass of wine. It had become Peter's custom to take his father a glass of wine each night shortly before Roland turned in. Everyone in the palace knew it and commented on what a loyal son Peter was. Roland enjoyed his son's company as much as the wine he brought, Flagg thought, but a certain maiden had caught Peter's eye, and he rarely stayed longer than half an hour with his father these days. If Flagg came one night after Peter had left, Flagg did not think the old man would turn down a second glass of wine. A very special glass of wine. A hot vintage, my lord, Flagg thought, a grin dawning on his narrow face. A hot vintage indeed, and why not? The vineyard was right next door to hell, I think, and when this stuff starts working in your guts, you'll think hell is where you are. Flagg threw back his head and began to laugh. Once his plan was laid, a plan that would rid him of both Roland and Peter forever, Flagg wasted no time. He first used all his wizardry to make the king well again. He was delighted to find that his magic potions worked better than they had for a long, long time. It was another irony. He earnestly wanted to make Roland better so the potions worked, but he wanted to make the king better so he could kill him and make sure everyone knew it was murder. It was really quite funny when you stopped to think it over. On a windy night, less than a week after the king's hacking cough had ceased, Flagg unlocked his desk and took out the teak box. He murmured,
"Well done,"
to the Cleffa Carrot, which squeaked mindlessly in reply, and then lifted the heavy lid and took out the smaller box inside. He used the key around his neck to open it and took out the packet that contained the dragon sand. He had bewitched this packet, and it was immune to the dragon sand's terrible power. Or so he thought. Flagg took no chances and removed the packet with a small pair of silver tweezers. He laid it beside one of the king's goblets on his desk. Sweat stood out on his forehead in great round drops, for this was ticklish work indeed. One little mistake and he would pay for it with his life. Flagg went out into the corridor that led to the dungeons and began to pant. He was hyperventilating. When you breathe rapidly, you fill your whole body with oxygen, and you can hold your breath for a long time. During the critical stage of his preparations, Flagg did not mean to breathe at all. But there would be no mistakes, big or little. He was having too much fun to die. He took a final great gasp of clean air from the barred window just outside the door to his apartment and re-entered his rooms. He went to the envelope, took his dagger from his belt, and delicately slit it open. There was a flat piece of obsidian, which the magician used as a paperweight on his desk. In those days, obsidian was the hardest rock known. Using the tweezers again, he grasped the packet, turned it upside down, and poured out most of the green sand. He saved back a tiny bit, hardly more than a dozen grains, but this bit of extra was extremely important to his plans. Hard as the obsidian was, the rock immediately began to smoke. 30 seconds had passed now. He picked up the obsidian, careful that not a single grain of dragon sand should touch his skin. If it did, it would work inward until it reached his heart and set it on fire. He tilted the stone over the goblet and poured it in. Now quickly, before the sand could begin to eat into the glass, he poured in some of the king's favorite wine, the same sort of wine Peter would be taking his father about now. The sand dissolved immediately. For a moment the red wine glimmered a sinister green, and then it returned to its usual color. 50 seconds. Flagg went back to his desk. He picked up the flat rock and took his dagger by its handle. Only a few grains of dragon sand had touched the blade when he slit through the paper, but already they were working their way in, and evil little streamers of smoke rose from the pox in the Anduin steel. He carried both the stone and the dagger out into the hallway.
70 seconds, and his chest was beginning to cry for air. 30 feet down the hallway, which led to the dungeon if you followed it far enough, a trip no one in Delane wanted to make, there was a grating in the floor. Flag could hear gurgling water, and if he had not been holding his breath, he would have smelled a foul stench. This was one of the castle's sewers. He dropped both the rock and the blade into it and grinned at the double splash in spite of his pounding chest. Then he hurried back to the window, leaned far out, and took breath after gasping breath. When he had his wind back, he returned to his study. Now only the tweezers, the packet, and the glass of wine stood on the desk. There was not so much as a grain of sand on the tweezers, and the bit of sand left inside the bewitched packet could not harm him as long as he took reasonable care. He felt he had done very well indeed so far. His work was by no means done, but it was well begun. He bent over the goblet and inhaled deeply. There was no danger now. When the sand was mixed with a liquid, its fumes became harmless and undetectable. Dragon sand made deadly vapors only when it touched a solid, such as stone, such as flesh. Flag held the goblet up to the light, admiring its bloody glow.
"A final glass of wine, my king,"
he said, and laughed until the two-headed parrot screamed in fear.
"Something to warm your guts."
He sat down, turned over his hourglass, and began to read from a huge book of spells. Flag had been reading from this book, which was bound in human skin, for 1,000 years and had gotten through only a quarter of it. To read too long of this book, written on the high, distant plains of Leng by a madman named Al-Hazred, was to risk madness. An hour. Just an hour. When the top half of his hourglass was empty, he could be sure Peter would have come and gone. An hour, and he could take Roland this final glass of wine. For a moment, Flag looked at the bone-white sand slipping smoothly through the waist of the hourglass, and then he bent calmly over his book. Roland was pleased and touched that Flag should have brought him a glass of wine that night before he went to bed. He drank it off in 2 large gulps and declared that it had warmed him greatly. Smiling inside his hood, Flag said,
"I thought it would, Your Highness."
Whether it was fate or only luck that caused Thomas to see Flag with his father that night is another question you must answer for yourself. I only know that he did see, and that it happened in large part because Flag had been at pains over the years to make a special friend of this friendless, miserable boy. I'll explain in a moment, but first I must correct a wrong idea you may have about magic. In stories of wizardry, there are 3 kinds that are usually spoken of almost carelessly, as if any second-class wizard could do them. These are turning lead into gold, changing one's shape, and making oneself invisible. The first thing you should know is that real magic is never easy, and if you think it is, just try making your least favorite aunt disappear the next time she comes to spend a week or two. Real magic is hard. And although it is easier to do evil magic than good, even bad magic is tolerably hard. Turning lead into gold can be done, once you know the names to call on, and if you can find someone to show you exactly the right trick of splitting the loaves of lead. Shape-changing and invisibility, however, are impossible, or so close to it that you might as well use the word. From time to time, Flag, who was a great eavesdropper, had listened to fools tell tales about young princes who escaped the clutches of evil genies by uttering a simple magic word and popping out of sight, or beautiful young princesses. In the stories, they were always beautiful, although Flag's experience had been that most princesses were spoiled rotten and, as the end products of long inbred family lines, ugly as sin and stupid in the bargain, who tricked great ogres into becoming flies, which they then quickly swatted. In most stories, the princesses were also good at swatting flies, although most of the princesses Flag had seen wouldn't have been able to swat a fly dying on a cold windowsill in December. In stories, it all sounded easy. In stories, people changed their shapes or turned themselves into walking window panes all the time. In truth, Flag had never seen either trick done. He had once known a great Anduin magician who believed he had mastered the trick of changing his shape, but after 6 months of meditation and nearly a week of incantations and a series of agonizing body postures, he uttered the last awesome spell and succeeded only in making his nose nearly 9 feet long and driving himself insane. And there had been fingernails growing out of his nose, Flagg remembered with a grim little smile. Great magician or not, the man had been a fool. Invisibility was likewise impossible, at least as far as Flagg himself had been able to determine, yet it was possible to make oneself dim. Yes, dim. That was really the best word for it, although others sometimes came to mind. Ghostly, transparent, unobtrusive. Invisibility was out of his reach, but by first eating a pizzle and then reciting a number of spells, it was possible to become dim. When one was dim, and a servant approached along a passageway, one simply drew aside and stood still and let the servant pass. In most cases, the servant's eyes would drop to his own feet or suddenly find something interesting to look at on the ceiling. If one passed through a room, conversation would falter and people would look momentarily distressed as if all were having gas pains at the same time. Torches and wall sconces grew smoky. Candles sometimes blew out. It was necessary to actually hide when one was dim, only if one saw someone whom one knew well. For whether one was dim or not, these people almost always saw. Dimness was useful, but it was not invisibility. On the night Flagg took the poisoned wine to Roland, he first made himself dim. He did not expect to see anyone he knew. It was after 9 o'clock now. The king was old and unwell, the days were short, and the castle went to bed early. When Thomas is king, Flagg thought, carrying the wine swiftly through the corridors, there will be parties every night. He already has his father's taste for drink, although he favors wine rather than beer or mead. It should be easy enough to introduce him to a few stronger drinks. After all, am I not his friend? Yes, when Peter is safely out of the way in the Needle and Thomas is king, there would be great parties every night. Until the people in the alleys and the baronies are choked enough to rise in bloody revolt, then there will be one final party, the greatest of all. But I don't think Thomas will enjoy it. Like the wine I'm bringing his father tonight, that party will be extremely hot. He did not expect to see anyone he knew, and he didn't. Only a few servants passed him, and they drew away from the place where he stood almost absently, as if they felt a cold draft. All the same, someone saw him. Thomas saw him through the eyes of Niner, the dragon his father had killed long ago. Thomas was able to do this because Flagg himself had taught him the trick. The way his father had rejected the gift of the boat had hurt Thomas deeply, and after that he tended to keep clear of his father. All the same, Thomas loved Roland and badly wanted to make him happy the way Peter made him happy. Even more than that, he wanted to make his father love him the way he loved Peter. In fact, Thomas would have been happy if their father had loved him even half as much. The trouble was, Peter had all the good ideas first. Sometimes Peter tried to share his ideas with Thomas, but to Thomas the ideas either sounded silly, until they worked, or else he feared he wouldn't be able to do his share of the work, as when Peter had made their father a set of Bendo men 3 years ago. "I'll give Father something better than a bunch of stupid old game pieces," Thomas had said haughtily, but what he was really thinking was that if he couldn't make his father a simple wooden sailboat, he would never be able to help make something as difficult as the 20-man Bendo army. So Peter made the game pieces alone over a period of 4 months. The infantrymen, the knights, the archers, the fusilier, the general, the monk. And of course, Roland had loved them even though they were a bit clumsy. He had immediately put away the jade Bendo set the great Ellender had carved for him 40 years before and put the one Peter had made for him in its place. When Thomas saw this, he crept away to his apartments and went to bed, although it was the middle of the afternoon. He felt as if someone had reached into his chest and cut off a tiny piece of his heart and made him eat it. His heart tasted very bitter to him, and he hated Peter more than ever, although part of him still loved his handsome older brother and always would, and although the taste had been bitter, he had liked it, because it was his heart. Now there was the business of the nightly glass of wine. Peter had come to Thomas and said, "I was thinking it would be nice if we brought Dad a glass of wine every night, Tom. I asked the steward, and he said he couldn't just give us a bottle because he has to make an accounting to the chief vintner at the end of each 6 month, but he said we could pool some of our money and buy a bottle of the Barony Fifth Vat, which is Father's favorite, and it's really not expensive. We'd have lots of our allowances left over, and I think that's the stupidest idea I ever heard," Thomas burst out. "All the wine belongs to Father, all the wine in the kingdom, and he can have as much of it as he wants. Why should we spend our money to give Father something he owns anyway? We'll enrich that fat little steward, that's all we'll do." Peter said patiently, "It will please him that we spent our money on him, even if it's something he owns anyway." "How do you know that?" Simply, maddeningly, Peter replied, "I just do." Thomas looked at him, scowling. How could he tell Peter that the chief vintner had caught him in the wine cellar, stealing a bottle of wine just the month before? The fat little pig had given him a shaking and threatened to tell his father if Thomas didn't give him a gold piece. Thomas had paid, tears of rage and shame standing in his eyes. "If it had been Peter, you would have turned the other way and pretended not to see, you slug," he thought. "If it had been Peter, you would have turned your back, because Peter is going to be king someday soon, and I'll just be a prince forever." It also occurred to him that Peter never would have tried to steal wine in the first place, but the truth of this thought only made him angrier at his brother. "I just thought," Peter began.
"You just thought, you just thought,"
Thomas mimicked savagely. "Well, go think somewhere else. When Father finds out you paid the chief vintner for his own wine, he'll laugh at you and call you a fool." But Roland hadn't laughed at Peter, hadn't called him a fool. He had called him a good son in a voice that was unsteady and almost weepy. Thomas knew, because he had crept after when Peter took their father the wine that first night. He watched through the eyes of the dragon and saw it all.
25. If you had asked Flagg straight out why he had shown Thomas that place and the secret passageway which led to it, he would have been able to give you no very satisfactory answer. That was because he didn't exactly know why he had done it. He had an instinct for mischief in his head, just as some people have a way with numbers or a clear sense of direction. The castle was very old, and there were many secret doors and passages in it. Flagg knew most of them. No one, not even he, knew all of them, but this was the only one he had ever shown Thomas. His instinct for mischief told him that this one might cause trouble, and Flagg simply obeyed his instinct. Mischief, after all, was Flagg's cake and pie. Every now and then he would pop into Thomas's room and cry,
"Tommy, you look glum. I've thought of something you might like to see. Want to go and have a look?"
He almost always said, "You look glum, Tommy," or "You look a bit in the dumps, Tommy," or "You look like you just sat on a pinch bug, Tommy," because he had a knack of showing up when Thomas was feeling particularly depressed or blue. Flagg knew that Thomas was afraid of him, and Thomas would find an excuse not to go with him unless he particularly needed a friend, and felt so low and unhappy he wouldn't be particular about which friend it was. Flagg knew this, but Thomas himself did not. His fear of Flagg ran deep. On the surface of his mind, he thought Flagg was a fine fellow, full of tricks and fun. Sometimes the fun was a bit mean, but that often suited Thomas's disposition. Do you think it strange that Flagg would know something about Thomas that Thomas didn't know about himself? It really isn't strange at all. People's minds, particularly the minds of children, are like wells, deep wells full of sweet water. And sometimes, when a particular thought is too unpleasant to bear, the person who has that thought will lock it into a heavy box and throw it into that well. He listens for the splash, and then the box is gone. Except it is not, of course. Not really. Flagg, being very old and very wise, as well as very wicked, knew that even the deepest well has a bottom, and just because a thing is out of sight doesn't mean it is gone. It is still there, resting at the bottom. And he knew that the caskets those evil, frightening ideas are buried in may rot, and the nastiness inside may leak out after a while and poison the water. And when the well of the mind is badly poisoned, we call the result insanity. If the magician showed him scary things in the castle sometimes, he did it because he knew that the more frightened of him Thomas was, the more power he would gain over Thomas, and he knew he could have that power because he knew something I've already told you, that Thomas was weak and often neglected by his father. Flagg wanted Thomas to be afraid of him, and he wanted to make sure that as the years passed, Thomas had to throw many of those locked boxes into the darkness inside him. If Thomas were to go insane at some point after he became king, well, what of that? It would make it easier for Flagg to rule. It would make his power all the greater. How did Flagg know the right times to visit Thomas and take him on these strange tours of the castle? Sometimes he saw what had happened to make Thomas sad or angry in his crystal. More often he simply felt an urge to go to Thomas and heeded it. That instinct for mischief rarely led him wrong. Once he took Thomas high into the eastern tower. They climbed stairs until Thomas was panting like a dog, but Flagg never seemed to lose his breath. At the top was a door so small that even Thomas had to crawl through it on his hands and knees. Beyond was a dark, rustling room with a single window. Flagg had led him to that window without a word, and when Thomas saw the view, the entire city of Delane, the near towns, and then the hills which stood between the near towns and the eastern barony marching off into a blue haze, he thought that the sight had been worth every stair his aching legs had climbed. His heart swelled with the beauty of it, and he turned to thank Flagg. But something about the white blur of the magician's face inside his hood had frozen the words on his lips.
"Now watch this,"
Flagg said, and held up his hand. A spurt of blue flame rose from his index finger, and the rustling sound in the room, which Thomas had first taken for the sound of the wind, turned to a rising whir of leathery wings. A moment later, Thomas was screaming and beating the air above his head as he blundered blindly back toward the tiny door. The little round room at the top of the castle's eastern tower had the best view in Delane, save for the cell at the top of the needle. But now he understood why no one visited it. The room was infested with huge bats. Disturbed by the light Flagg had raised, they whirled and swooped. Later, after they were out and Flagg had quieted the boy, Thomas, who hated bats, had been in hysterics. The magician insisted it was just a joke meant to cheer him up. Thomas believed him, but for weeks after he awoke screaming with nightmares in which bats flapped around his head, got caught in his hair, and ripped at his face with their sharp claws and ratty teeth. On another excursion, Flagg took him to the king's treasure room and showed him the mounds of gold coins, tall stacks of gold bars, and the deep bins marked emeralds, diamonds, rubies, fire gems, and so on. "Are they really full of jewels?" Thomas asked.
"Look and see,"
Flagg said. He opened one of the bins and pulled out a handful of uncut emeralds. They sparkled wildly in his hand.
"My father's name!" Thomas gasped.
"Oh, that's nothing. Look over here. Pirate treasure, tell me."
He showed Thomas a pile of booty from the encounter with the Anduin pirates some 12 years ago. The Delane treasury was rich, the few treasure room clerks old, and this particular heap hadn't been sorted yet. Thomas gasped at heavy swords with jeweled hilts, daggers with blades that had been crusted with serrated diamonds so they would cut deeper,
heavy kill balls made of rhodochrosite.
"All this belongs to the kingdom?"
Thomas asked in an awed voice.
"It all belongs to your father,"
Flagg replied, although Thomas had actually been correct.
"Someday it will all belong to Peter."
"And me," Thomas said with the 10-year-old's confidence.
"No,"
Flagg said, just the right tinge of regret in his voice.
"Just to Peter, because he's the oldest, and he'll be king."
"He'll share," Thomas said, but with the slightest tremor of doubt in his voice. Peter always shares.
Peter's a fine boy. And I'm sure you're right. He'll probably share. But no one can make a king share, you know. No one can make a king do anything he doesn't want to do.
He looked at Thomas to gauge the effect of this remark, then looked back at the deep, shadowy treasure room. Somewhere, one of the aged clerks was droning out a count of ducats.
Such a lot of treasure. And all for one man.
Flagg remarked.
It's really something to think about, isn't it, Tommy?
Thomas said nothing, but Flagg had been well pleased. He saw that Tommy was thinking about it all right, and he judged that another of those poisoned caskets was tumbling down into the well of Thomas's mind. Ka-splash! And that was indeed so. Later, when Peter proposed to Thomas that they share the expense of the nightly bottle of wine, Thomas had remembered the great treasure room, and he remembered that all the treasure in it would belong to his brother. Easy for you to talk so blithely of buying wine. Why not? Someday you'll have all the money in the world. Then, about a year before he brought the poisoned wine to the king, on impulse, Flagg had shown Thomas this secret passage, and on this one occasion his usually unerring instinct for mischief might have led him astray. Again, I leave it for you to decide.
Tommy, you look down in the dumps,
he cried. The hood of his cloak was pushed back on that day, and he looked almost normal. Almost. Tommy felt down in them. He had suffered through a long luncheon at which his father had praised Peter's scores in geometry and navigation to his advisers with the most lavish superlatives. Roland had never rightly understood either. He knew that a triangle had three sides and a square had four. He knew you could find your way out of the woods when you were lost by following Old Star in the sky, and that was where his knowledge ended. That was where Thomas's knowledge ended, too, so he felt that luncheon would never be done. Worse, the meat was just the way his father liked it, bloody and barely cooked. Bloody meat made Thomas feel almost sick. "My lunch didn't agree with me, that's all," he said to Flagg.
"Well, I know just the thing to cheer you up,"
Flagg said.
"I'll show you a secret of the castle, Tommy, my boy."
Thomas was playing with a bugger-lug bug. He had it on his desk and had set his schoolbooks around it in a series of barriers. If the trundling beetle looked as if he might find a way out, Thomas would shift one of the books to keep him in. "I'm pretty tired," Thomas said. This was not a lie. Hearing Peter praised so highly always made him feel tired.
"You'll like it,"
Flagg said in a tone that was mostly wheedling, but a little threatening, too. Thomas looked at him apprehensively. "There aren't any bats, are there?" Flagg laughed cheerily, but that laugh raised goose flesh on Thomas's arms anyway. He clapped Thomas on the back.
"Not a bat. Not a drip. Not a draft. Warm as toast. And you can peek at your father, Tommy."
Thomas knew that peeking was just another way of saying spying, and that spying was wrong. But this had been a shrewd shot all the same. This next time the bugger-lug bug found a way to escape between two of the books, Thomas let it go. "All right," he said. "But there better not be any bats." Flagg slipped an arm around the boy's shoulders.
"No bats, I swear. But here's something for you to mull over in your mind, Tommy. You'll not only see your father, you'll see him through the eyes of his greatest trophy."
Thomas's own eyes widened with interest. Flagg was satisfied. The fish was hooked and landed.
What do you mean?
Come and see for yourself,
was all he would say. He led Thomas through a maze of corridors. You would have become lost very soon, and I probably would have gotten lost myself before long.
But Thomas knew this way as well as you know your way through your own bedroom in the dark. At least, he did until Flagg led him aside.
They had almost reached the king's own apartments when Flagg pushed open a recessed wooden door that Thomas had never really noticed before. Of course it had always been there, but in castles there are often doors, whole wings even, that have mastered the art of being dim. This passage was quite narrow. A chambermaid with an armload of sheets passed them. She was so terrified to have met the king's magician in this slim stone throat that it seemed she would happily have shrunk into the very pores of the stone blocks to avoid touching him. Thomas almost laughed because sometimes he felt a little like that himself when Flagg was around. They met no one else at all. Faintly, from below them, he could hear dogs barking, and that gave him a rough idea of where he was. The only dogs inside the castle proper were his father's hunting dogs, and they were probably barking because it was time for them to be fed. Most of Roland's dogs were now almost as old as he was, and because he knew how the cold ached in his own bones, Roland had commanded that a kennel be made for them right here in the castle. To reach the dogs from his father's main sitting chamber, one went down a flight of stairs, turned right, and walked 10 yards or so up an interior corridor. Sir Thomas knew they were about 30 feet to the right of his father's private rooms. Flagg stopped so suddenly that Thomas almost ran into him. The magician looked swiftly around to make sure they had the passageway to themselves. They did.
4th stone up from the one at the bottom with the chip in it,
Flagg said.
Press it quick.
Ah, there was a secret here, all right, and Thomas loved secrets. Brightening, he counted up 4 stones from the one with the chip and pressed. He expected some neat little bit of jiggery-pokery, a sliding panel perhaps, but he was quite unprepared for what did happen. The stones slid in with perfect ease to a depth of about 3 inches. There was a click. An entire section of wall suddenly swung inward, revealing a dark vertical crack. This wasn't a wall at all. It was a huge door. Thomas's jaw dropped. Flagg slapped Thomas's bottom.
Quick, I said, you little fool,
he cried in a low voice. There was urgency in his voice, and this wasn't simply put on for Thomas's benefit, as many of Flagg's emotions were. He looked right and left to verify that the passage was still empty.
Go now.
Thomas looked at the dark crack that had been revealed and thought uneasily about bats again, but one look at Flagg's face showed him that this would be a bad time to attempt a discussion on the subject. He pushed the door open wider and stepped into the darkness. Flagg followed at once. Thomas heard the low flap of the magician's cloak as he turned and shoved the wall closed again. The darkness was utter and complete, the air still and dry. Before he could open his mouth to say anything, the blue flame at the tip of Flagg's index finger flared alight, throwing a harsh blue-white fan of illumination. Thomas cringed without even thinking about it, and his hands flew up. Flagg laughed harshly.
No bats, Tommy. Didn't I promise?
Nor were there. The ceiling was quite low, and Thomas could see for himself. No bats, and warm as toast, just as the magician had promised. By the light of Flagg's magic finger flare, he could also see they were in a secret passage which was about 25 feet long. Walls, floor, and ceiling were covered with ironwood boards. He couldn't see the far end very well, but it looked perfectly blank. He could still hear the muffled barking of the dogs.
When I said be quick, I meant it,
Flagg said. He bent over Thomas, a vague, looming shadow that was, in this darkness, rather bat-like itself. Thomas drew back a step uneasily. As always, there was an unpleasant smell about the magician, a smell of secret powders and bitter herbs.
You know where the passage is now, and I'll not be the one to tell you not to use it. But if you're ever caught using it, you must say you discovered it by accident.
The shape loomed even closer, forcing Thomas back another step.
If you say I showed it to you, Tommy, I'll make you sorry.
I'll never tell, Thomas said. His words sounded thin and shaky.
Good. Better yet, if no one ever sees you using it. Spying on a king is serious business, prince or not. Now, follow me, and be quiet.
Flagg led him to the end of the passageway. The far wall was also dressed with ironwood, but when Flagg raised the flame that burned from the tip of his finger, Thomas saw two little panels. Flagg pursed his lips and blew out the light. In utter blackness, he whispered,
Never open these two panels with a light burning. He might see. He's old, but he still sees well. He might see something, even though the eyeballs are of tinted glass.
What?
Shh! There isn't much wrong with his ears, either.
Thomas fell quiet, his heart pounding in his chest. He felt a great excitement that he didn't understand. Later he thought that he had been excited because he knew in some way what was going to happen. In the darkness he heard a faint sliding sound, and suddenly a dim ray of light, torchlight, lit the darkness. There was a second sliding sound, and a second ray of light appeared. Now he could see Flagg again, very faintly, and his own hands when he held them up before him. Thomas saw Flagg step up to the wall and bend a little. Then most of the light was cut out as he put his eyes to the two holes through which the rays of light fell. He looked for a moment, then grunted and stepped away. He motioned to Thomas.
Have a look,
he said. More excited than ever, Thomas cautiously put his eyes to the holes. He saw clearly enough, although everything had an odd greenish-yellow aspect. It was as if he were looking through smoked glass. A sense of perfect, delighted wonder rose in him. He was looking down into his father's sitting room. He saw his father slouched by the fire in his favorite chair, one with high wings which threw shadows across his lined face. It was very much the room of a huntsman. In our world, such a room would often be called a den, although this one was as big as some ordinary houses. Flaring torches lined the long walls. Heads were mounted everywhere, heads of bear, of deer, of elk, of wildebeest, of cormorant. There was even a grand feather ex, which is the cousin of our legendary bird, the phoenix. Thomas could not see the head of Niner, the dragon his father had killed before he was born, but this did not immediately register on him. His father was picking morosely at a sweet. A pot of tea steamed near at hand. That was all that was really happening in that great room that could have, and at times had, held upward of 200 people. Just his father with a fur robe draped around him having a solitary afternoon tea. Yet Thomas watched for a time that seemed endless. His fascination and his excitement with this view of his father cannot be told. His heartbeat, which had been rapid before, doubled. Blood sang and pounded in his head. His hands clenched into fists so tight that he would later discover bloody crescent moons imprinted into his palms where his fingernails had bitten. Why was he so excited simply to be looking at an old man picking half-heartedly at a piece of cake? Well, first you must remember that the old man wasn't just any old man, he was Thomas's father. And spying, sad to say, has its own attraction. When you can see people doing something and they don't see you, even the most trivial actions seem important. After a while, Thomas began to feel a little ashamed of what he was doing, and that was not really surprising. Spying on a person is a kind of stealing, after all. It's stealing a look at what people do when they think they are alone. But that is also one of its chief fascinations, and Thomas might have looked for hours if Flagg had not murmured,
Do you know where you are, Tommy?
I don't think so, he was going to add, but of course he did know. His sense of direction was good, and with a little thought he could imagine the reverse of this angle. He suddenly understood what Flagg meant when he said he, Thomas, would see his father through the eyes of Roland's greatest trophy. He was looking down at his father from a little more than halfway up the west wall, and that was where the greatest head of all was hung, that of Niner, his father's dragon.
He might see something, even though the eyeballs are of tinted glass. Now he understood that, too. Thomas had to clap his hands to his mouth to stifle a shrill giggle. Flags slid the little panels shut again, but he, too, was smiling.
No,
Thomas whispered.
No, I want to see more.
Not this afternoon,
Flag said.
You've seen enough this afternoon. You can come again when you want. Although, if you come too often, you will surely be caught. Now come on, we're going back.
Flag relit the magic flame and led Thomas down the corridor again. At the end, he put the light out, and there was another sliding sound as he opened a peephole. He guided Thomas's hand to it so he would know where it was, and then bade him look.
Notice that you can see the passageway in both directions,
Flag said.
Always be careful to look before you open the secret door, or someday you will be surprised.
Thomas put one eye to the peephole and saw, directly across the corridor, an ornate window with glass sides that angled slightly into the passageway. It was much too fancy for such a small passageway, but Thomas understood without having to be told that it had been put here by whoever had made the secret passageway. Looking into the angled sides, he could indeed see a ghostly reflection of the corridor in both directions.
Empty,
Flag whispered.
Yes,
Thomas whispered back. Flag pushed an interior spring, again guiding Thomas's hand to it for future reference, and the door clicked open.
Quickly now,
Flag said. They were out and the door was shut behind them in a trice. 10 minutes later, they were back in Thomas's rooms.
Enough excitement for one day,
Flag said.
Remember what I told you, Tommy. Don't use the passageway so often that you'll be caught. And if you are caught,
Flag's eyes glittered grimly.
Remember that you found that place by accident.
I will,
Thomas said quickly. His voice was high and it squeaked like a hinge that needed oil. When Flag looked at him that way, his heart felt like a bird caught in his chest, fluttering in panic. XXVII. Thomas heeded Flag's advice not to go often, but he did use the passageway from time to time and peeked at his father through the glass eyes of Niner, peeked into a world where everything became greeny gold. Going away later with a pounding headache, as he almost always did, he would think, "Your head aches because you were seeing the way dragons must see the world, as if everything was dried out and ready to burn." And perhaps Flag's instinct for mischief in this matter was not so bad at all, because by spying on his father, Thomas learned to feel a new thing for Roland. Before he knew about the secret passage, he had felt love for him, and often a sorrow that he could not please him better, and sometimes fear. Now he learned to feel contempt as well. Whenever Thomas spied into Roland's sitting room and found his father in company, he left again quickly. He only lingered when his father was alone. In the past, Roland rarely had been, even in such rooms as his den, which was a part of his private apartments. There was always one more urgent matter to be attended to, one more advisor to see, one more petition to hear. But Roland's time of power was passing. As his importance waned with his good health, he found himself remembering all the times he had cried to either Sasha or Flag, "Won't these people ever leave me alone?" The memory brought a rueful smile to his lips. Now that they did, he missed them. Thomas felt contempt because people are rarely at their best when they are alone. They usually put their masks of politeness, good order, and good breeding aside. What's beneath? Some warty monster? Some disgusting thing that would make people run away screaming? Sometimes, perhaps, but usually it's nothing bad at all. Usually people would just laugh if they saw us with our masks off. Laugh, like a revolted face, or do both at the same time. Thomas saw that his father, whom he had always loved and feared, who had seemed to him the greatest man in the world, often picked his nose when he was alone.
He would root around in first one nostril and then the other until he got a plump green booger. He would regard these with solemn satisfaction, turning each one this way and that in the firelight, the way a jeweler might turn a particularly fine emerald. Most of these he would then rub under the chair in which he was sitting. Others, I regret to say, he popped into his mouth and munched, with an expression of reflective enjoyment on his face. He would have only a single glass of wine at night, the glass which Peter brought him, but after Peter left he drank what seemed to Thomas huge amounts of beer. It was only years later that Thomas came to realize that his father hadn't wanted Peter to see him drunk, and when he needed to urinate he rarely used the commode in the corner. Most times he simply stood up and pissed into the fire, often farting as he did so. He talked to himself. He would sometimes walk around the long room like a man who was not sure where he was, speaking either to the air or to the mounted heads.
"I remember that day we got Shoebonsy,"
he would say to one of the elkheads. Another of his eccentricities was that he had named every one of the trophies.
"I was with Bill Squathings and that fellow with the great lump on the side of his face. I remember how you came through the trees and Bill let loose, and then that fellow with the lump let loose, then I let loose."
Then his father would demonstrate how he had let loose by raising his leg and farting, even as he mimed drawing back a bowstring and letting fly, and he would laugh an old man's shrill, unpleasant cackle. Thomas would slide the little panels back after a while and slink down the corridor again, his head pounding and an uneasy grin on his face, the head and grin of a boy who has been eating green apples and knows he may be sicker by morning than he is now. This was the father he had always loved and feared? He was an old man who farted out stinking clouds of steam. This was the king his loyal subjects called Roland the Good? He pissed into the fire, sending up more clouds of steam. This was the man who made his heart break by not liking his boat? He talked to the stuffed heads on his walls, calling them silly names like Bonesy and Stagpool and Pucker String. He picked his nose and sometimes ate the boogers. "I don't care for you anymore," Thomas would think, checking the peephole to make sure the corridor was empty and then creeping back to his room like a felon. "You're a filthy, silly old man, and you're nothing to me, nothing at all. No!" But he was something to Thomas. Some part of him went on loving Roland just the same. Some part of him wanted to go to his father so his father would have something better to talk to than a bunch of stuffed heads on the walls. Still, there was that other part of him that liked spying better. 28. The night that Flagg came to King Roland's private rooms with the glass of poisoned wine was the first occasion in a very long time that Thomas had dared spy. There was a good reason for this. One night, about 3 months before, Thomas found himself unable to sleep. He tossed and turned until he heard the keep watchman cry 11. Then he got up, dressed, and left his